torturers have their own lives to lead. I am not the center of their universe. Mandel's underling probably spends his days counting bags in the commissary, or patrolling the earthworks, grumbling to himself about the heat. Mandel himself, I am sure, spends more time polishing his straps and buckles than he spends on me. When the mood takes him, he comes and gives me a lesson in humanity. How long can I withstand the randomness of their attacks? And what will happen if I succumb, weep, grovel, while yet the attacks go on? They call me into the yard. I stand before them, hiding my nakedness, nursing my sore hand, a tired old bear made tame by too much baiting. "Run," Mandel says. I run around the yard under the blazing sun. When I slacken, he slaps me on the buttocks with his cane and I trot faster. The soldiers leave their siesta and watch from the shade. The scullery maids hang over the kitchen door. Children stare through the bars of the gate. "I cannot," I gasp. "My heart." I stop, hang my head, clutch my chest. Everyone waits patiently while I recover myself. Then the cane prods me and I shamble on, moving no faster than a man walks. Or else I do tricks for them. They stretch a rope at knee height and I jump back and forth over it. They call the cook's little grandson over and give him one end to hold. "Keep it steady," they say. "We don't want him to trip." The child grips his end of the rope with both hands, concentrating on this important task, waiting for me to jump. I balk. The point of the cane finds its way between my buttocks and prods. "Jump," Mandel murmurs. I run, make a little skip, blunder into the rope, and stand there. I smell of shit. I'm not permitted to wash. The flies follow me everywhere, circling around the appetizing sore on my cheek, alighting if I stand still for a moment. The looping movement of my hand before my face to chase them away has become as automatic as the flick of a cow's tail. "Tell him he must do better next time," Mandel says to the boy. The boy smiles and looks away. I sit down in the dust to wait for the next trick. "Do you know how to skip?" he says to the boy. "Give the rope to the man and ask him to show you how to skip." I skip. It cost me agonies of shame the first time I had to come out of my den and stand naked before these idlers or jerk my body about for their amusement. Now I am past shame. My mind is turned wholly to the menace of the moment, when my knees turn to water, or my heart grips me like a crab and I have to stand still. And each time I discover with surprise that after a little rest, after the application of a little pain, I can be made to move, to jump, or skip, or crawl, or run a little further. Is there a point at which I will lie down and say, "Kill me, I would rather die than go on"? Sometimes I think I am approaching that point, but I am always mistaken. There is no consoling grandeur in any of this. When I wake up groaning in the night, it is because I am reliving in dreams the pettiest degradations. There is no way of dying allowed me, it seems, except like a dog in a corner. Then one day they throw open the door, and I step out to face not two men, but a squad standing to attention. "Here," says Mandel, and hands me a woman's calico smock. "Put it on." "Why?" "Very well, if you want to go naked, go naked." I slip the smock over my head. It reaches halfway down my thighs. I catch a glimpse of the two youngest maids ducking back into the kitchen, dissolving in giggles. My wrists are caught behind my back and tied. "The time has come, magistrate," Mandel whispers in my ear. "Do your best to behave like a man." I am sure I can smell liquor on his breath. They march me out of the yard. Under the mulberry trees where the earth is purple with the juice of fallen berries, there is a knot of people waiting. Children are scrambling about on the branches. As I approach, everyone falls silent. A soldier tosses up the end of a new white hemp rope. One of the children in the tree catches it, loops it over a branch, and drops it back. I know this is only a trick. A new way of passing the afternoon for men bored with the old torments. Nevertheless, my bowels turn to water. "Where is the colonel?" I whisper. No one pays any heed. "Do you want to say something?" says Mandel. "Say whatever you wish. We give you this opportunity." I look into his clear blue eyes, as clear as if there were crystal lenses slipped over his eyeballs. He looks back at me. I have no idea what he sees. Thinking of him, I have said the words torture, torturer, to myself. But they are strange words, and the more I repeat them, the more strange they grow, till they lie like stones on my tongue. Perhaps this man, and the man he brings along to help him with his work, and their colonel, are torturers. Perhaps that is their designation on three cards in a pay office somewhere in the capital. Though it is more likely that the cards called them security officers. But when I look at him, I see simply the clear blue eyes, the rather rigid good looks, the teeth slightly too long where the gums are receding. He deals with my soul. Every day he folds the flesh aside and exposes my soul to the light. He has probably seen many souls in the course of his working life, but the care of souls seems to have left no more mark on him than the care of hearts leaves on the surgeon. "I am trying very hard to understand your feelings towards me," I say. I cannot help mumbling. My voice is unsteady. I am afraid, and the sweat is dripping from me. Much more than an opportunity to address these people to whom I have nothing to say, would I appreciate a few words from you, so that I can come to understand why you devote yourself to this work, and can hear what you feel towards me, whom you have hurt a great deal, and now seem to be proposing to kill. Amazed, I stare at this elaborate utterance as it winds its way out of me. Am I mad enough to intend a provocation? "Do you see this hand?" he says. He holds his hand an inch from my face. "When I was younger," he flexes the fingers, "I used to be able to poke this finger." He holds up the index finger. "Through a pumpkin shell." He puts the tip of his finger against my forehead and presses. I take a step backwards. They even have a cap ready for me, a salt bag which they slip over my head and tie around my throat with a string. Through the mesh, I watch them bring up the ladder and prop it against the branch. I am guided to it. My foot is set on the lowest rung. The noose is settled under my ear. "Now, climb," says Mandel. I turn my head and see two dim figures holding the end of the rope. "I can't climb with my hands tied," I say. My heart is hammering. "Climb," he says, steadying me by the arm. The rope tightens. "Keep it tight," he orders. I climb. He climbs behind me, guiding me. I count 10 rungs. Leaves brush against me. I stop. He grips my arm tighter. "Do you think we are playing?" he says. He talks through clenched teeth in a fury I do not understand. "Do you think I don't mean what I say?" My eyes sting with sweat inside the bag. "No," I say. "I do not think you are playing." As long as the rope remains taut, I know they are playing. If the rope goes slack and I slip, I will die.
"Then what do you want to say to me?"
"I want to say that nothing passed between myself and the barbarians concerning military matters. It was a private affair. I went to return the girl to her family, for no other purpose. Is that all you want to say to me? I want to say that no one deserves to die. In my absurd frock and bag, with a nausea of cowardice in my mouth, I say, I want to live, as every man wants to live. To live and live and live, no matter what. That isn't enough. He lets my arm go. I teeter on my 10th rung, the rope saving my balance. Do you see? He says. He retreats down the ladder, leaving me alone. Not sweat, but tears. There is a rustling in the leaves near me, a child's voice.
Can you see, Uncle?
No. Hey, monkeys, come down, calls someone from below. Through the taut rope, I can feel the vibration of their movements in the branches. So I stand for a long while, balancing carefully on the rung, feeling the comfort of the wood in the curve of my soul, trying not to waver, keeping the tension of the rope as constant as possible. How long will a crowd of idlers be content to watch a man stand on a ladder? I would stand here till the flesh dropped from my bones, through storm and hail and flood, to live. But now the rope tightens. I can even hear it rasp as it passes over the bark, till I must stretch to keep it from throttling me. This is not a contest of patience, then. If the crowd is not satisfied, the rules are changed. But of what use is it to blame the crowd? A scapegoat is named, a festival is declared. The laws are suspended. Who would not flock to see the entertainment? What is it I object to in these spectacles of abasement and suffering and death that our new regime puts on, but their lack of decorum? What will my own administration be remembered for, besides moving the shambles from the marketplace to the outskirts of the town 20 years ago in the interests of decency? I try to call out something, a word of blind fear, a shriek, but the rope is now so tight that I am strangled, speechless. The blood hammers in my ears. I feel my toes lose their hold. I am swinging gently in the air, bumping against the ladder, flailing with my feet. The drumbeat in my ears becomes slower and louder till it is all I can hear. I am standing in front of the old man, screwing up my eyes against the wind, waiting for him to speak. The ancient gun still rests between his horse's ears, but it is not aimed at me. I am aware of the vastness of the sky all around us, and of the desert. I watch his lips. At any moment now he will speak. I must listen carefully to capture every syllable, so that later, repeating them to myself, poring over them, I can discover the answer to a question which, for the moment, has flown like a bird from my recollection. I can see every hair of the horse's mane, every wrinkle of the old man's face, every rock and furrow of the hillside. The girl, with her black hair braided and hanging over her shoulder in barbarian fashion, sits her horse behind him. Her head is bowed. She too is waiting for him to speak. I sigh. What a pity, I think. It is too late now. I am swinging loose. The breeze lifts my smock and plays with my naked body. I am relaxed, floating, in a woman's clothes. What must be my feet touch the ground, though they are numb to all feeling. I stretch myself out carefully, at full length, light as a leaf. Whatever it is that has held my head so tightly slackens its grip. From inside me comes a ponderous grating. I breathe. All is well. Then the hood comes off. The sun dazzles my eyes. I am hauled to my feet. Everything swims before me. I go blank. The word flying whispers itself somewhere at the edge of my consciousness. Yes, it is true. I have been flying. I am looking into the blue eyes of Mandel. His lips move, but I hear no words. I shake my head, and having once started, find that I cannot stop. "I was saying," he says, "now we will show you another form of flying."
"He can't hear you," someone says. "He can hear," says Mandel.
He slips the noose from my neck and knots it around the cord that binds my wrists.
"Pull him up."
If I can hold my arm stiff, if I am acrobat enough to swing a foot up and hook it around the rope, I will be able to hang upside down and not be hurt. That is my last thought before they begin to hoist me. But I am as weak as a baby. My arms come up behind my back, and as my feet leave the ground, I feel a terrible tearing in my shoulders, as though whole sheets of muscle are giving way. From my throat comes the first mournful dry bellow, like the pouring of gravel. Two little boys drop out of the tree, and hand in hand, not looking back, trot off. I bellow again and again. There is nothing I can do to stop it. The noise comes out of a body that knows itself damaged, perhaps beyond repair, and roars its fright. Even if all the children of the town should hear me, I cannot stop myself. Let us only pray that they do not imitate their elders' games. Or tomorrow there will be a plague of little bodies dangling from the trees. Someone gives me a push and I begin to float back and forth in an arc, a foot above the ground, like a great old moth with its wings pinched together, roaring, shouting.
"He is calling his barbarian friends," someone observes. "That is barbarian language you hear."
There is laughter. 5. The barbarians come out at night. Before darkness falls, the last goat must be brought in. The gates barred, a watch set in every lookout to call the hours. All night, it is said, the barbarians prowl about bent on murder and rapine. Children in their dreams see the shutters part, and fierce barbarian faces leer through.
"The barbarians are here,"
the children scream, and cannot be comforted. Clothing disappears from washing lines, food from larders, however tightly locked. The barbarians have dug a tunnel under the walls, people say. They come and go as they please, take what they like. No one is safe any longer. The farmers still till the fields, but they go out in bands, never singly. They work without heart. The barbarians are only waiting for the crops to be established, they say, before they flood the fields again. Why doesn't the army stop the barbarians? People complain. Life on the frontier has become too hard. They talk of returning to the old country, but then remember that the roads are no longer safe because of the barbarians. Tea and sugar can no longer be bought over the counter as the shopkeepers hoard their stocks. Those who eat well eat behind closed doors, fearful of awaking their neighbor's envy. 3 weeks ago, a little girl was raped. Her friends, playing in the irrigation ditches, did not miss her till she came back to them bleeding, speechless. For days she lay in her parents' home, staring at the ceiling. Nothing would induce her to tell her story. When the lamp was put out, she would begin to whimper. Her friends claim a barbarian did it. They saw him running away into the reeds. They recognized him as a barbarian by his ugliness. Now all children are forbidden to play outside the gates, and the farmers carry clubs and spears when they go to the fields. The higher feeling runs against the barbarians, the tighter I huddle in my corner, hoping I will not be remembered. It is a long time since the second expeditionary force rode out so bravely, with its flags and trumpets and shining armor and prancing steeds, to sweep the barbarians from the valley and teach them a lesson they and their children and grandchildren would never forget. Since then, there have been no dispatches, no communiques. the exhilaration of the times when there used to be daily military parades on the square. Displays of horsemanship, exhibitions of musketry, has long since dissipated. Instead, the air is full of anxious rumors. Some say that the entire 1,000-mile frontier has erupted into conflict, that the northern barbarians have joined forces with the western barbarians, that the army of the empire is too thinly stretched, that one of these days it will be forced to give up the defense of remote outposts like this one to concentrate its resources on the protection of the heartland. Others say that we receive no news of the war only because our soldiers have thrust deep into the enemy's territory and are too busy dealing out heavy blows to send dispatches. Soon, they say, when we least expect it, our men will come marching back weary but victorious, and we shall have peace in our time. Among the small garrison that has been left behind, there is more drunkenness than I have ever known before, more arrogance towards the townspeople. There have been incidents in which soldiers have gone into shops, taken what they wanted, and left without paying. Of what use is it for the shopkeeper to raise the alarm, when the criminals and the civil guard are the same people? The shopkeepers complain to Mandel, who is in charge under the emergency powers while Jarl is away with the army. Mandel makes promises, but does not act. Why should he? All that matters to him is that he should remain popular with his men. Despite the parade of vigilance on the ramparts and the weekly sweep along the lakeshore, for lurking barbarians, though none has ever been caught, discipline is lax. Meanwhile, I, the old clown who lost his last vestige of authority the day he spent hanging from a tree in a woman's underclothes, shouting for help, the filthy creature who for a week licked his food off the flagstones like a dog, because he had lost the use of his hands, I'm no longer locked up. I sleep in a corner of the barracks yard. I creep around in my filthy smock. When a fist is raised against me, I cower. I live like a starved beast at the back door, kept alive perhaps only as evidence of the animal that skulks within every barbarian lover. I know I am not safe. Sometimes I can feel the weight of a resentful gaze resting upon me. I do not look up. I know that for some, the attraction must be strong to clear the yard by putting a bullet through my skull from an upstairs window. There has been a drift of refugees to the town. Fisherfolk from the tiny settlements dotted along the river and the northern lakeshore, speaking a language no one understands, carrying their households on their backs, with their gaunt dogs and rickety children trailing behind them. People crowded around them when they first came. "Was it the barbarians who chased you out?" they asked, making fierce faces, stretching imaginary bows. No one asked about the imperial soldiery or the brush fires they set. There was sympathy for these savages at first, and people brought them food and old clothing, until they began to put up their thatched shelters against the wall on the side of the square near the walnut trees, and their children grew bold enough to sneak into kitchens and steal. And one night a pack of their dogs broke into the sheepfold and tore out the throats of a dozen ewes. Feelings then turned against them. The soldiers took action, shooting their dogs on sight, and one morning when the men were still down at the lake, tearing down the entire row of shelters. For days, the fisherfolk hid out in the reeds. Then, one by one, their little thatched huts began to reappear, this time outside the town, under the north wall. Their huts were allowed to stand, but the sentries at the gate received orders to deny them entry. Now that rule has been relaxed, and they can be seen hawking strings of fish from door to door in the mornings. They have no experience of money. They are cheated outrageously. They will part with anything for a thimbleful of rum. They are a bony, pigeon-chested people. Their women seem always to be pregnant. Their children are stunted. In a few of the young girls, there are traces of a fragile, liquid-eyed beauty. For the rest, I see only ignorance, cunning, slovenliness. Yet what do they see in me, if they ever see me? A beast that stares out from behind a gate, the filthy underside of this beautiful oasis where they have found a precarious safety. One day a shadow falls across me where I doze in the yard. A foot prods me, and I look up into Mandel's blue eyes. "Are we feeding you well?" he says. "Are you growing fat again?" I nod, sitting at his feet. "Because we can't go on feeding you forever." There is a long pause while we examine each other. "When are you going to begin working for your keep?" "I am a prisoner, awaiting trial. Prisoners awaiting trial are not required to work for their keep. That is the law. They are maintained out of the public coffer." "But you are not a prisoner. You are free to go as you please." He waits for me to take the ponderously offered bait. I say nothing. He goes on. "How can you be a prisoner when we have no record of you? Do you think we don't keep records? We have no record of you. So you must be a free man." I rise and follow him across the yard to the gate. The guard hands him the key and he unlocks it. "You see? The gate is open." I hesitate before I pass through. There is something I would like to know. I look into Mandel's face, at the clear eyes, windows of his soul, at the mouth from which his spirit utters itself. "Have you a minute to spare?" I say. We stand in the gateway, with the guard in the background pretending not to hear. I say, "I am not a young man anymore, and whatever future I had in this place is in ruins." I gesture around the square, at the dust that scuds before the hot late summer wind, bringer of blights and plagues. "Also, I have already died one death, on that tree, only you decided to save me. So there is something I would like to know before I go. If it is not too late, with the barbarian at the gate." I feel the tiniest smile of mockery brush my lips. I cannot help it. I glance up at the empty sky. "Forgive me if the question seems impudent, but I would like to ask, how do you find it possible to eat afterwards? After you have been working with people?" That is a question I have always asked myself about executioners and other such people. "Wait, listen to me a moment longer. I am sincere. It has cost me a great deal to come out with this, since I am terrified of you. I need not tell you that. I am sure you are aware of it. Do you find it easy to take food afterwards? I have imagined that one would want to wash one's hands, but no ordinary washing would be enough. One would require priestly intervention, a ceremonial of cleansing, don't you think? Some kind of purging of one's soul, too. That is how I have imagined it. Otherwise, how would it be possible to return to everyday life? To sit down at table, for instance, and break bread with one's family or one's comrades?" He turns away, but with a slow, claw-like hand, I manage to catch his arm. "No, listen," I say. "Do not misunderstand me. I am not blaming you or accusing you. I am long past that. Remember, I too have devoted a life to the law. I know its processes. I know that the workings of justice are often obscure. I am only trying to understand. I am trying to understand the zone in which you live. I am trying to imagine how you breathe and eat and live from day to day, but I cannot. That is what troubles me. If I were he, I say to myself, my hands would feel so dirty that it would choke me. He wrenches himself free and hits me so hard in the chest that I gasp and stumble backwards.
You bastard, he shouts. You fucking old lunatic. Get out. Go and die somewhere. When are you going to put me on trial?
I shout at his retreating back. He pays no heed. There is nowhere to hide, and why should I? From dawn to dusk, I am on view on the square, roaming around the stalls or sitting in the shade of the trees. And gradually, as word gets around that the old magistrate has taken his knocks and come through, people cease to fall silent or turn their backs when I come near. I discover that I am not without friends, particularly among women, who can barely conceal their eagerness to hear my side of the story. Roaming the streets, I pass the quartermaster's plump wife hanging out the washing. We greet.
And how are you, sir? She says. We heard that you had such a hard time.
Her eyes glitter, avid, though cautious.
Won't you come in and have a cup of tea?
So we sit together at the kitchen table, and she sends the children to play outside. And while I drink tea and munch steadily at a plate of the delicious oatmeal biscuits she bakes, she plays out the first moves in this roundabout game of question and answer.
You were gone so long? We wondered if you would ever be coming back. And then, all the trouble you had. How things have changed. There was none of this commotion when you were in charge. All these strangers from the capital, upsetting things.
I take my cue, sigh.
Yes, they don't understand how we go about things in the provinces, do they? All this trouble over a girl.
I gobble another biscuit. A fool in love is laughed at, but in the end, always forgiven.
To me, it was simply a matter of common sense to take her back to her family. But how could one make them understand that?
I ramble on. She listens to these half-truths, nodding, watching me like a hawk. We pretend that the voice she hears is not the voice of the man who swung from the tree shouting for mercy, loud enough to waken the dead.
Anyhow, let us hope it is all over. I still have pains.
I touch my shoulder.
One's body heals so slowly as one gets older.
So I sing for my keep. And if I am still hungry in the evening, if I wait at the barracks gate for the whistle that calls the dogs and slip in quietly enough, I can usually wheedle out of the maids the leftovers from the soldiers' supper. A bowl of cold beans, or the rich scrapings of the soup pot, or half a loaf of bread. Or in the mornings I can saunter over to the inn, and leaning over the flap of the kitchen door, breathe in all the good smells, marjoram and yeast and crisp chopped onions and smoky mutton fat. Mai, the cook, greases the baking pans. I watch her deft fingers dip into the pot of lard and coat the pan in three swift circles. I think of her pastries, the renowned ham and spinach and cheese pie she makes, and feel the saliva spurt in my mouth.
So many people have left, she says,
turning to the great ball of dough.
I can't even begin to tell you. A sizable party left only a few days ago. One of the girls from here. The little one with the long straight hair, you may remember her. She was one of them. She left with her fellow.
Her voice is flat as she imparts the information to me, and I'm grateful for her considerateness.
Of course, it makes sense, she continues. If you want to leave, you must leave now. It's a long road, dangerous too. and the nights are getting colder.
She talks about the weather, about the past summer and signs of approaching winter, as though where I had been in my cell not 300 paces from where we stand, I had been sealed off from hot and cold, dry and wet. To her, I realize, I disappeared and then reappeared, and in between was not part of the world. I have been listening and nodding and dreaming while she talks. Now I speak.
You know, I say, when I was in prison,
in the barracks, not in the new prison, in a little room they locked me into, I was so hungry that I did not give a thought to women, only to food. I lived from one mealtime to the next. There was never enough for me. I bolted my food like a dog and wanted more. Also, there was a great deal of pain at different times. My hand, my arms, as well as this. I touched the thickened nose, the ugly scar under my eye, by which I am beginning to learn people are surreptitiously fascinated. When I dreamed of a woman, I dreamed of someone who would come in the night and take the pain away. A child's dream. What I did not know was how longing could store itself away in the hollows of one's bones, and then one day, without warning, flood out. What you said a moment ago, for instance, the girl you mentioned. I was very fond of her, I think you know that, though delicacy prevented you. When you said she was gone, I confess, it was as if something had struck me, here, in the breast. A blow. Her hands moved deftly, pressing circles out of the sheet of dough with the rim of a bowl, catching up the scraps, rolling them together. She avoids my eyes. I went upstairs to her room last night, but the door was locked. I shrugged it off. She has a lot of friends. I never thought I was the only one. But what did I want? Somewhere to sleep, certainly. But more, too. Why pretend? We all know what old men seek is to recover their youth in the arms of young women. She pounds the dough, kneads it, rolls it out. A young woman herself with children of her own, living with an exacting mother. What appeal am I making to her as I ramble on about pain, loneliness? Bemused, I listen to the discourse that emerges from me. Let everything be said, I told myself when I first faced up to my tormentors. Why clamp your lips stupidly together? You have no secrets. Let them know they are working on flesh and blood. Declare your terror. Scream when the pain comes. They thrive on stubborn silence. It confirms to them that every soul is a lock they must patiently pick. Bear yourself. Open your heart. So I shouted and screamed and said whatever came into my head. Insidious rationale. For now what I hear when I loosen my tongue and let it sail free is the subtle whining of a beggar. Do you know where I slept last night? I hear myself saying. Do you know that little lean-to at the back of the granary? But above all, it is food that I crave, and more intensely with every passing week. I want to be fat again. There is a hunger upon me day and night. I wake up with my stomach yawning. I cannot wait to be on my rounds, loitering at the barracks gate, to sniff the bland, watery aroma of oatmeal and wait for the burnt scrapings, cajoling children to throw me down mulberries from the trees, stretching over a garden fence to steal a peach or two, passing from door to door, a man down on his luck, the victim of an infatuation, but cured now, ready with a smile to take what is offered, a slice of bread and jam, a cup of tea, in the middle of the day perhaps a bowl of stew or a plate of onions and beans, and always fruit. Apricots, peaches, pomegranates, the wealth of a bounteous summer. I eat like a beggar, gobbling down my food with such appetite, wiping my plate so clean that it does the heart good to see it. No wonder I am, day by day, creeping back into the good books of my countrymen. And how I can flatter, how I can woo. More than once have I had a tasty snack prepared especially for me, a mutton chop fried with peppers and chives, or a slice of ham and tomato on bread with a wedge of goat's milk cheese. If I can carry water or firewood in return, I do so gladly, as a token, though I am not as strong as I used to be. And if for the time being I have exhausted my sources in the town, for I must be careful not to become a burden on my benefactors, I can always stroll down to the fisherfolk's camp and help them clean fish. I have learned a few words of their language. I am received without suspicion. They understand what it is to be a beggar. They share their food with me. I want to be fat again, fatter than ever before. I want a belly that gurgles with contentment when I fold my palms over it. I want to feel my chin sink into the cushion of my throat and my breasts wobble as I walk. I want a life of simple satisfactions. I want, vain hope, never to know hunger again. Nearly 3 months since it departed, and still there is no news of the expeditionary force. Instead, terrible rumors everywhere that the force has been lured into the desert and wiped out, that unknown to us it has been recalled to defend the homeland, leaving the frontier towns for the barbarians to pick like fruit whenever they choose to. Every week, there is a convoy of the prudent leaving town, going east, 10 or 12 families traveling together to visit relatives, as the euphemism has it, till things settle down again. They leave, leading pack trains, pushing hand carts, carrying packs on their backs, their very children laden like beasts. I have even seen a long, low, four-wheeled cart drawn by sheep. Pack animals can no longer be bought. Those who depart are the sensible ones, the husbands and wives who lie awake in bed, whispering, making plans, cutting losses. They leave their comfortable homes behind, locking them, till we return, taking the keys as a memento. By the next day, gangs of soldiers have broken in, looted the houses, smashed the furniture, fouled the floors. Resentment builds up against those who are seen to be making preparations to go. They are insulted in public, assaulted or robbed with impunity. Now there are families that simply disappear in the dead of night, bribing the guards to open the gates for them, taking the east road and waiting at the first or second stopping place till the party that accumulates is large enough to travel safely. The soldiery tyrannizes the town. They have held a torchlight meeting on the square to denounce cowards and traitors and to affirm collective allegiance to the empire. "We stay," has become the slogan of the faithful. The words are to be seen daubed on walls everywhere. I stood in the dark on the edge of the huge crowd that night. No one was brave enough to stay at home, listening to these words chanted ponderously, menacingly, from thousands of throats. A shiver ran down my back. After the meeting, the soldiers led a procession through the streets. Doors were kicked in, windows broken, a house set on fire. Till late at night, there was drinking and carousing on the square. I looked out for Mandel but did not see him. It may be that he has lost control at the garrison, if indeed the soldiers were ever prepared to take orders from a policeman. When they were first quartered on the town, these soldiers, strangers to our ways, conscripts from all over the empire, were welcomed coolly. "We don't need them here," people said. "The sooner they go out and fight the barbarians, the better." They were denied credit in the shops. Mothers locked their daughters away from them. But after the barbarians made their appearance on our doorstep, that attitude changed. Now that they seem to be all that stands between us and destruction, these foreign soldiers are anxiously courted. A committee of citizens makes a weekly levy to hold a feast for them, roasting whole sheep on spits, laying out gallons of rum. The girls of the town are theirs for the taking. They are welcome to whatever they want, as long as they will stay and guard our lives. And the more they are fawned on, the more their arrogance grows. We know we cannot rely on them. With the granary nearly empty and the main force vanished like smoke, what is there to hold them once the feasting stops? All we can hope for is that they will be deterred from deserting us by the rigors of winter travel. For premonitions of winter are everywhere. In the early hours of the morning, a chilly breeze rises in the north. The shutters creak, sleepers huddle closer. The sentries wrap their cloaks tight, turn their backs. Some nights I wake up shivering on my bed of sacks and cannot get to sleep again. When the sun comes up, it seems farther away each day. The earth grows cold even before sunset. I think of the little convoys of travelers strung out along hundreds of miles of road, heading for a motherland most have never seen, pushing their handcarts, goading their horses, carrying their children, nursing their provisions, day by day abandoning at the roadside tools, kitchenware, portraits, clocks, toys, everything they believed they might rescue from the ruin of their estates, before they realized that at most they might hope to escape with their lives. In a week or two, the weather will be too treacherous for any but the hardiest to set out. The bleak north wind will be howling all day, withering life on the stalk, carrying a sea of dust across the wide plateau, bringing sudden flurries of hail and snow. I cannot imagine myself, with my tattered clothes and cast-off sandals, stick in hand, pack on back, surviving that long march. My heart would not be in it. What life can I hope for away from this oasis? The life of an indigent bookkeeper in the capital, coming back every evening after dusk to a rented room in a back street, with my teeth slowly falling out and the landlady sniffing at the door. If I were to join the exodus, it would be as one of those unobtrusive old folk who one day slip away from the line of march, settle down in the lee of a rock, and wait for the last great cold to begin creeping up their legs. I wander down the wide road down to the lakeside. The horizon ahead is already grey, merging into the grey water of the lake. Behind me, the sun is setting in streaks of gold and crimson. From the ditches comes the first cricket song. This is a world I know and love, and do not want to leave. I have walked this road by night since my youth, and come to no harm. How can I believe that the night is full of the flitting shadows of barbarians? If there were strangers here, I would feel it in my bones. The barbarians have withdrawn with their flocks into the deepest mountain valleys, waiting for the soldiers to grow tired and go away. When that happens, the barbarians will come out again. They will graze their sheep and leave us alone. We will plant our fields and leave them alone. And in a few years, the frontier will be restored to peace. I pass the ruined fields, cleared by now and plowed afresh, cross the irrigation ditches and the shore wall. The ground beneath my soles grows soft. Soon I am walking on soggy marsh grass, pushing my way through reed breaks, striding ankle deep in water, in the last violet light of dusk. Frogs plop into the water before me. Nearby I hear a faint rustle of feathers as a marsh bird crouches, ready to fly. I wade deeper, parting the reeds with my hands, feeling the cool slime between my toes. The water, holding the warmth of the sun longer than the air, resists, then gives way before each stride. In the early hours of the morning, the fishermen pole their flat-bottomed boats out across this calm surface and cast their nets. What a peaceful way to make a living. Perhaps I should leave off my beggar's trade and join them in their camp outside the wall, build myself a hut of mud and reeds, marry one of their pretty daughters, feast when the catch is plentiful, tighten my belt when it is not. Calf deep in the soothing water, I indulge myself in this wistful vision. I am not unaware of what such daydreams signify, dreams of becoming an unthinking savage, of taking the cold road back to the capital, of groping my way out to the ruins in the desert, of returning to the confinement of my cell, of seeking out the barbarians and offering myself to them to use as they wish. Without exception, they are dreams of ends, dreams not of how to live, but of how to die. And everyone I know, in that walled town sinking now into darkness, I hear the two thin trumpet calls that announce the closing of the gates, is similarly preoccupied. Everyone but the children. The children never doubt that the great old trees in whose shade they play will stand forever, that one day they will grow to be strong like their fathers, fertile like their mothers, that they will live and prosper and raise their own children and grow old in the place where they were born. What has made it impossible for us to live in time, like fish in water, like birds in air, like children? It is the fault of empire. Empire has created the time of history. Empire has located its existence not in the smooth, recurrent spinning time of the cycle of the seasons, but in the jagged time of rise and fall, of beginning and end, of catastrophe. Empire dooms itself to live in history and plot against history. One thought alone preoccupies the submerged mind of empire. How not to end, how not to die, how to prolong its era. By day it pursues its enemies. It is cunning and ruthless. It sends its bloodhounds everywhere. By night it feeds on images of disaster, the sack of cities, the rape of populations, pyramids of bones, acres of desolation. A mad vision, yet a virulent one. I, wading in the ooze, am no less infected with it than the faithful Colonel Jarl as he tracks the enemies of empire through the boundless desert, sword unsheathed, to cut down barbarian after barbarian, until at last he finds and slays the one whose destiny it should be, or if not his, then his sons or unborn grandsons, to climb the bronze gateway to the summer palace and topple the globe surmounted by the tiger rampant that symbolizes eternal dominion, while his comrades below cheer and fire their muskets in the air. There is no moon. In darkness, I grope my way back to dry land and on a bed of grass, wrapped in my cloak, fall asleep. I wake up stiff and cold from a flurry of confused dreams. The red star has barely moved in the sky. As I pass along the road to the fisherman's camp, a dog starts to bark. In a moment it is joined by another, and the night bursts out in a clamor of barking, shouts of alarm, screams. Dismayed, I shout out at the top of my voice, "It is nothing!" But I am not heard. I stand helpless in the middle of the road. Someone runs past me down towards the lake. Then another body cannons into me, a woman I know at once, who gasps in terror in my arms, before she breaks free and is gone. There are dogs, too, snarling about me. I whirl and cry out as one snaps at my legs, tears my skin, retreats. The frenzied yapping is all round me. From behind the walls, the dogs of the town bay their response. I crouch and circle, tensed for the next attack. The brassy wail of trumpets cuts through the air. The dogs bark louder than ever. Slowly, I shuffle towards the camp, till one of the huts suddenly looms against the sky. I push aside the mat that hangs over the doorway and pass into the sweaty warmth where until a few minutes ago people slept. The clamor outside dies down, but no one returns. The air is stale, drowsy. I would like to sleep, yet I am disturbed by the resonance of that soft impact on me in the road. Like a bruise, my flesh retains the imprint of the body that for a few seconds rested against me. I fear what I am capable of. Of coming back tomorrow in daylight, still aching with the memory, and asking questions until I discover who it was who ran into me in the dark, so as to build upon her, child or woman, an even more ridiculous erotic adventure. There is no limit to the foolishness of men of my age. Our only excuse is that we leave no mark of our own on the girls who pass through our hands. Our convoluted desires, our ritualized lovemaking, our elephantine ecstasies are soon forgotten. They shrug off our clumsy dance as they drive straight as arrows into the arms of the men whose children they will bear, the young and vigorous and direct. Our loving leaves no mark. Whom will that other girl with the blind face remember? Me with my silk robe and my dim lights and my perfumes and oils and my unhappy pleasures? Or that other cold man with the mask over his eyes, who gave the orders and pondered the sounds of her intimate pain? Whose was the last face she saw plainly on this earth, but the face behind the glowing iron? Though I cringe with shame, even here and now, I must ask myself whether, when I lay head to foot with her, fondling and kissing those broken ankles, I was not, in my heart of hearts, regretting that I could not engrave myself on her as deeply. However kindly she may be treated by her own people, she will never be courted and married in the normal way. She is marked for life as the property of a stranger, and no one will approach her save in the spirit of lugubrious sensual pity that she detected and rejected in me. No wonder she fell asleep so often. No wonder she was happier peeling vegetables than in my bed. From the moment my steps paused and I stood before her at the barracks gate, she must have felt a miasma of deceit closing about her, envy, pity, cruelty, all masquerading as desire. And in my lovemaking, not impulse, but the laborious denial of impulse. I remember her sober smile. From the very first, she knew me for a false seducer. She listened to me. Then she listened to her heart, and right